3. Catching Walter Cunningham in the schoolyard gave me some pleasure. But when I was rubbing his nose in the dirt, Jim came by and told me to stop. "You're bigger than he is," he said. "He's as old as you, nearly," I said. "He made me start off on the wrong foot." "Let him go, Scout." "Why?" "He didn't have any lunch," I said, and explained my involvement in Walter's dietary affairs. Walter had picked himself up and was standing quietly listening to Jim and me. His fists were half-cocked, as if expecting an onslaught from both of us. I stomped at him to chase him away, but Jim put out his hand and stopped me. He examined Walter with an air of speculation. "Your daddy, Mr. Walter Cunningham, from Old Sarum?" he asked. And Walter nodded. Walter looked as if he'd been raised on fish food. His eyes, as blue as Dill Harris's, were red-rimmed and watery. There was no color in his face except at the tip of his nose, which was moistly pink. He fingered the straps of his overalls, nervously picking at the metal hooks. Jim suddenly grinned at him. "Come on home to dinner with us, Walter," he said. "We'd be glad to have you." Walter's face brightened, then darkened. Jim said, "Our daddy's a friend of your daddy's. Scout here, she's crazy. She won't fight you anymore." "I wouldn't be too certain of that," I said. Jim's free dispensation of my pledge irked me, but precious noontime minutes were ticking away. "Yeah, Walter, I won't jump on you again. Don't you like butter beans? Our cow's a real good cook." Walter stood where he was, biting his lip. Jim and I gave up, and we were nearly to the Radley place when Walter called, "Hey, I'm coming." When Walter caught up with us, Jim made pleasant conversation with him. "A haint lives there," he said cordially, pointing to the Radley house. "Ever hear about him, Walter?" "Reckon I have," said Walter. "Almost died first year I come to school at them pecans. Folks say he pisoned 'em and put 'em over on the school side of the fence." Jim seemed to have little fear of Boo Radley now that Walter and I walked beside him. Indeed, Jim grew boastful. "I went all the way up to the house once," he said to Walter. "Anybody who went up to the house once ought not to still run every time he passes it," I said to the clouds above. "And who's running, Miss Pris?" "You are when ain't nobody with you." By the time we reached our front steps, Walter had forgotten he was a Cunningham. Jim ran to the kitchen and asked Calpurnia to set an extra plate. We had company. Atticus greeted Walter and began a discussion about crops neither Jim nor I could follow. "Reason I can't pass the first grade, Mr. Finch, is I've had to stay out every spring and help Papa with the chopping. But there's another one at the house now that's field size." "Did you pay a bushel of potatoes for him?" I asked, but Atticus shook his head at me. While Walter piled food on his plate, he and Atticus talked together like two men, to the wonderment of Jim and me. Atticus was expounding upon farm problems when Walter interrupted to ask if there was any molasses in the house. Atticus summoned Calpurnia, who returned bearing the syrup pitcher. She stood waiting for Walter to help himself. Walter poured syrup on his vegetables and meat with a generous hand. He would probably have poured it into his milk glass had I not asked what the Sam Hill he was doing. The silver saucer clattered when he replaced the pitcher, and he quickly put his hands in his lap. Then he ducked his head. Attica shook his head at me again. "But he's gone and drowned his dinner in syrup," I protested. "He's poured it all over." It was then that Calpurnia requested my presence in the kitchen. She was furious, and when she was furious, Calpurnia's grammar became erratic. When in tranquility, her grammar was as good as anybody's in Macomb. Attica said Calpurnia had more education than most colored folks. When she squinted down at me, the tiny lines around her eyes deepened. "There's some folks who don't eat like us," she whispered fiercely, "but you ain't called on to contradict 'em at the table when they don't. That boy's your company, and if he wants to eat up the tablecloth, you let him, you hear? He ain't company, Cal. He's just a Cunningham. Hush your mouth. Don't matter who they are. Anybody sets foot in this house is your company, and don't you let me catch you remarking on their ways like you was so high and mighty. Your folks might be better than the Cunninghams, but it don't count for nothing the way you're disgracing them. If you can't act fit to eat at the table, you can just sit here and eat in the kitchen. Calpurnia sent me through the swinging door to the dining room with a stinging smack. I retrieved my plate and finished dinner in the kitchen, thankful, though, that I was spared the humiliation of facing them again. I told Calpurnia to just wait. I'd fix her. One of these days when she wasn't looking, I'd go off and drown myself in Barker's Eddy, and then she'd be sorry. Besides, I added, she'd already got me in trouble once today. She had taught me to write, and it was all her fault. Hush you fussin', she said. Jim and Walter returned to school ahead of me, staying behind to advise Atticus of Calpurnia's iniquities was worth a solitary sprint past the Radley place. She likes Jim better than she likes me, anyway, I concluded and suggested that Atticus lose no time in packing her off. Have you ever considered that Jim doesn't worry her half as much? Atticus's voice was flinty. I've no intention of getting rid of her, now or ever. We couldn't operate a single day without Cal. Have you ever thought of that? You think about how much Cal does for you, and you mind her, you hear? I returned to school and hated Calpurnia steadily until a sudden shriek shattered my resentments. I looked up to see Miss Caroline standing in the middle of the room, sheer horror flooding her face. Apparently, she had revived enough to persevere in her profession. "It's alive!" she screamed.